Episode 23 of Season 17, Hamilton Sizes Up Interactive Luggage.
Gmail stops scanning email. Neural networks provide ancient wisdom. 4x4s don't measure up, branching narratives, unstable rolling luggage, and the geeks throw away their shot.
My name is Lyle Troxell, and in the air room with me is Brian Young. He's a programmer, conference producer, and father extraordinaire. Hey, Brian, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, it's so good to be here.
It's good to see you.
Thank you.
Of course, I just saw you last week, but hey, it's again a fresh day.
Yes, but there's nobody to look out upon our adoring fans. It's a little bit different experience here in the booth.
Wait, we have fans?
The live show was a lot of fun. We got to meet a lot of people. I have that episode up, so please don't forget to hear that one. And it was a blast to meet people. I had a good time doing that.
We had a really interesting crowd there. We can talk about it later.
And now we're back at the Netflix podcasting studio in Los Gatos. And we have with us Ben Jaffe. He's a programmer, musician, and podcaster. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
I'm sorry you missed last week's show. It was a lot of fun, but it's really good to see you, and welcome.
Absolutely. It's been a while.
Another live event that I went to recently was theater. And actually, I would say it's more of an opera. I went and saw Hamilton with my family, and it was friggin' fantastic.
It's a hip opera.
Do you know anything about it's a hip opera?
Hip hop opera.
Do you know anything about Hamilton, Ben?
Yes, I do.
How so?
Well, you actually know this because we were just talking about this before
the
show.
Magic of radio.
Yeah. It's fantastic. If you hate Hamilton, you might want to skip ahead 5 minutes because we're probably going to talk about it for a couple minutes. It's a beautiful, beautiful show. It's eloquent. It's thought provoking. It's incredibly well executed. If you actually see the performance, if you listen to the soundtrack, that's also very well executed.
I've been listening to the soundtrack consistently since it came out because my kids are very much into musical theater. My son is addicted to it. And
Do you know it?
Well, my kids know it verbatim and can do all of the quick dialogue fast. Me, I'd say in the family, maybe I'm 4 out of 9, I would say. There's only 5 of us, though, so it's low in the totem pole.
Okay.
Just above the dogs.
Yeah. All right. I ask because I made an app. To test your knowledge of, not yours,
what
but to test
app?
One's knowledge.
You make a
of
Chrome extension app?
No, I'm done with Chrome extensions. They're horrible.
Whoa, mark the date, everybody.
Chrome extensions are the worst idea ever because, you know, you get someone to install it.
What kind of app is it then?
It's a real app. It like has a home and
is it an app or an
to a URL. It's an application. It's an app. I don't know. It's a website that does some stuff.
All right. What's the domain? Or is it not public yet?
It's public, but nobody knows about it. I will tell you about it right now. All right, you want to type it in?
Breaking news, everybody.
Keep in mind, this is not done.
Mm.
It doesn't have a score. It's a quiz, but it doesn't have a score.
Okay, great.
https://. Ben Jaffe, that's 2 F's and 1 E, .github.io/Hamilton-quiz. /. Okay, you're going there.
I failed.
Womp womp.
You don't have 2 E's.
I said 2 F's and 1 E.
I know. Why did I do 2 E's? I know your name.
Do you get there?
Yes. Frighten.
It says, do you really know every word to Hamilton? These words occur only once in Hamilton. What words come after or before?
Fightin.
Yeah.
The word is fightin.
The word is fightin with an apostrophe. Different from fighting.
Can you at least give me a couple notes that are around that word?
There are no notes in that. I actually know where this is. Do you?
Is there an... No. But I cheated and gives the hint phrase, and it says, bleatin' and fightin'.
Bleatin' and fightin'.
The bleatin' and fightin', yeah.
Between all the bleatin' and fightin' I've been reading and writing.
Oh, yes.
We
nice.
Need to handle... So go ahead and type in weave. And actually, you don't need to type the apostrophe either.
We could really use your daughters on the show right now. Lyle.
Between all the bleeding and fighting, I've been reading and writing. IVE. This is great radio.
I've been reading and writing. Cool.
We need to handle our financial situation. Are we a nation of states? What's the state of our nation?
Nice.
Do you know what comes after that? I memorized it this weekend.
Ah, no.
I'm past patiently waiting. I'm passionately smashing every expectation.
Yeah, see, my
every
kids can do this a lot faster. But yeah, okay. What I'll do is I'll record with my kids and hopefully insert into the show here so you can hear
that
me.
That sounds great.
Awesome. What a fun app.
Yeah. You can also press I give up.
Yep.
And it'll tell you the context and you can go on. And I really need to add a score account.
No, score just means that you might lose.
Yes.
If you use the app, you're winning.
Because I want to tweet this at the Traveling Hamilton cast members. Because they know every word to Hamilton.
They do. In fact, yeah.
There's one guy who, when I saw it, he was playing King George. He was the understudy for King George. Mm-hmm. And I guess the guy who played King George normally was sick. He is also the understudy to Aaron Burr. And he's also the understudy to Hamilton, or at least
he has a bit of work on his hands.
So he knows a lot of words.
So one of the things I loved about the production is the lighting was both a major aspect of the show and supported the performance.
Right.
Lots of times lighting can be dominant if you notice it. This, you notice it and it totally supports, which is hard to do in lighting, as you know, being a lighting designer.
Definitely, yeah. Well, I'm not a lighting designer, but I did do a little bit of lighting design when I was majoring in theater at UC Santa Cruz. And it's really hard to do that craft without calling attention to yourself,
yeah.
Right? It's
kind
in fact,
of, most of the time when you're calling attention to yourself, you've done something wrong.
Yeah, well, that's especially true in audio. Like, if someone's like, man, the mix is, who's doing sound? You're like, ooh, I've failed.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, fantastic show. Expensive tickets. They'll come down in a decade. I don't know.
If you have the privilege to see it, do so.
Yeah. But if you don't, if you have a Spotify membership or something like that, you can listen to the soundtrack. And it is fantastic and still recommended.
Are you using Spotify?
I do use Spotify.
Huh. You use Spotify for a long time.
Yeah.
You were using Spotify before it was in the States. You came back from Europe on your wanderings and said, Spotify's awesome. I was like, okay, whatever, Ben. And now,
no, I was not using it. I saw their ad. They had a really good ad.
Oh.
I thought it was a really awesome. Good ad. No, really, that is what sold me.
That's cool.
It was kind of a like philosophical, nostalgic look back on the transformation of music over the years, and the way that they edited it was really cool.
And you like music?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Brian, let's talk about what Google will stop doing.
Yeah, speaking of playing games with words, so one of the things that's always been notable about Gmail, ever since it came out, I think they did this from day one, but maybe I'm misremembering that, is they have run your emails through their system to try to find words that will allow them to advertise specifically to you based on the conversations of the people you're talking with.
And this isn't employees reading your email. It's algorithms looking for words and things like that.
Right, right.
And
so
it didn't start in the very beginning. When Gmail was totally a beta thing, there was no advertising revenue. They might have had a system in place already, but they actually weren't placing ads at the time.
Yeah, well, with Google, often it's hard to tell when something's beta or released.
It is true.
So
I remember
memory,
Gmail said beta at the bottom for like a lot longer than you'd expect.
Yeah.
I think it was yesterday they turned that off.
We're talking a decade or something. Yeah. So anyways, for most of the time Gmail's been out, we've had conversations about privacy and about how they're scanning your email. And as Ben says, they're not actually looking at it. They're just running through their systems to advertise to you. Well, that's finally going to end. And that's going to stop because Google has an interesting thing going on with it. They are trying to become more... they're trying to get into the enterprise system, into the enterprise community, and be used by enterprises more and more. And they're finding that this perception that Google is looking at everything you email is getting in the way of all sorts of areas of their business, and they're going to stop doing it to consumers. And the interesting thing is they've never done it for their corporate customers, and this is going to be interesting if they can even get the word out about this, because I think they will turn this off and nobody will ever notice.
It's too late, basically. Huh?
Yeah. But the thing is, you're still going to see ads in your own personal Gmail, which I never see because I never use the web interface myself. You're still going to see ads there, and they're still going to be using your web search history and other avenues where they have information about you and what they should advertise to you about. They just won't be using your conversations in your actual email.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, in the corporate environment, they've been for a long time not scanning the email and doing ads because, of course, they charge the corporations for the Gmail service. There's no reason to recoup revenue additionally on top of that. So it's interesting that they're also going to turn that off for everybody in hopes that it will spread that methodology to, or that idea that they don't do it through people that might pick up the email service.
Yeah, and of course the money they can make off of enterprise is probably far more than they can make off consumers or advertising.
We are solely a Google shop here. That's like our major app for Docs. We use all the Google Docs. At Netflix, excuse me. And also Gmail. We use that very much. Does Facebook use Gmail internally?
No.
No, I didn't think so.
We use Outlook. I hate it. Oh, it's horrible.
Oh, man, Outlook. That's been years since I used that. Actually, I used Outlook at 4D.
Still use Outlook.
It's an Exchange server, right? You guys probably don't use Exchange server, though.
I am okay with Outlook. I just... Google Docs is so much better than every other product out there. And I'm
Doc sharing.
I miss it so much.
Yeah, I mean... So at Netflix, we have this big open and freedom and responsibility thing where a lot of documents are open. So a lot of the Google Docs are open to all employees. So when you need to find something, you best know how to search for that thing because
right.
It is really hard to filter out. Now, of course, it has all the searching capabilities. You can do like a dash, you know, negative in front of it to try to remove people. Finding it normally by author is easier. But yeah, it's a little challenging in that sense. But I think that's true with any kind of large document sharing thing across a company.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But I'm just talking about functionality when you're authoring a doc.
Oh, or sharing a doc and commenting and
it's
stuff.
It's so much better.
Fantastic. By the way, I can't find the first time we ever mentioned Gmail on GeekSpeak, but of course GeekSpeak was before Gmail existed, so we did mention it when it first came out. But I did find a quote from you on an article you covered, Ben, in September 11th, 2010, which is a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you say it says Facebook passes Google in surfers time. So at this time in August, people spent a total of 41.1 million minutes on Facebook. Some site said. And about 9.9% of their web surfing minutes for the month. They just barely surpassed 39.8 million minutes, or 9.6% people spent of all time using Google Inc.'s site combined, including YouTube and the free Gmail program. The free Gmail email program.
The free
I love that you had to specify that.
Yeah. Wow.
Free Gmail email program, yeah. Google News and other content sites. So in that August of 2010, Facebook overshot its traffic by outside metrics of all the Google names.
Gmail's been around since 2004.
Wow, 2004.
And it was beta for 5 years.
Oh, I was only off by half a decade.
But they were, I mean, it was really beta for like less than a year. They just had the beta thing. Actually, when they removed the beta thing, there was a Google, what do they call those things? Google Labs extension or something like that to re-add beta to the icon.
Just to make it more familiar.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Humans like that.
Ben, please tell me about construction. And when I'm talking about construction, I mean the classical wood type.
Right.
I know you're a software engineer, but we're going to talk about wood.
I built something the other – A week and 2 days ago, a friend and I built a pergola. Do you know what a pergola is?
No.
Do you know what, what's another word for pergola? It's like a shade structure.
Oh, okay.
Not gondola. There are so
like
many words
awning.
For that. Like an awning, but yeah, awnings are freestanding.
No, awnings are normally attached
so
to
like
the building.
Freestanding awning. Anyway. Building a freestanding
like an
awning
arbor?
Pergola arbor. Yeah, it's like an arbor. So I built an arbor. And so I had to go to Home Depot and go buy wood and all that stuff.
What kind of wood did you buy for that?
I bought some like
2x2 probably?
Yeah, 2x4, 2x6, and 4x4s at 8 feet, 12 feet, 16 feet. I fit it all in my Toyota Yaris.
Nice.
Four-door sedan. Yeah.
Okay, so go on with your article now that we've talked a little bit about wood measurements.
Yeah, well, what is a 4x4? How big is a 4x4?
A 4x4 is 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches in whatever length you're getting.
Yeah.
And the reason I know that is because I've done a lot of woodworking.
Yeah.
And do you know what a 1x6 is?
First we'll do 2x4s. 2x4s are
1.5.
By 3.5. So you're just shaving off half an inch, right?
Yeah, and it's not percentage of the amount of wood, it's actually half inch off.
And you're talking now a 1x6
yes.
would be, I'm guessing, a 6 would become 5.5.
Yes.
but the one becomes 0.75.
Yes, very good. It loses a quarter.
You only shave off a quarter.
And you know, if I want to get a piece of wood that actually is 1 inch thick, what I actually call that?
Non-dressed?
4-4. That's not, I mean, you might say what non-dressed. 4-4. 4-4 means 4 quarters. So you say, I'm not sure about this, but if you wanted a 4x4 that was actually 4x4, you'd say 4-4, 4x4. But you might not. You might say 16-16. Or but I'm not really sure.
Or you get a 4.5x4.5, which then gets shaved down.
No, that doesn't happen.
That doesn't exist.
What, no, it doesn't exist.
What about rough hewn?
Well, see, yes, it's true you get rough hewn, but if you get asked for a 2x4 rough hewn, it's very likely you'll get a 3.6. Because you can shave that amount off to make it clean and get a 3.5. So the reason why we lost that half inch in the States was because you can actually make a lot, it can be cheaper. But more importantly, if you side something with a half inch of material, then you do have 4 inches total. Mm-hmm. So I'm not exactly sure of the history of it, but it is something you have to kind of just know when you're dealing with wood.
Yeah.
Well, all I can say about the history of it is my house, which was built in 1945
is all made by 4-4 with 4-4.
4-4.
Yes.
When I do any work on it and I take that siding off and I see it, it's like, wow, that really is big. What is that? I don't know that size. But then when I try to nail into it, you have to get the most industrial strength nails to get into that thing. It is so fossilized at this point.
Interesting.
It's amazing.
It gets harder over time.
So for a very long time, you would go to a hardware store and you would buy a 2x4 or a 4x4, and they would be those kind of slightly smaller, odd sizes. Well, as it turns out, it's been this way for a long time, but there are now 2 federal class action lawsuits against Menards and Home Depot, both filed by what's it called?
Company. Firm. Group of people. If it's people, mob.
Attorney. Same Pro. Attorney. That's the word I was looking for.
What's a plural noun of attorney or lawyer?
Attorneys or lawyers?
Yeah. No, the fun plural name. You know, like...
Oh, like a gaggle of attorneys.
A gaggle of geese, yeah. Attorneys would have to be like a legislature of... or a lawsuit. A lawsuit of attorneys.
A lawsuit is... that's pretty good.
Class action of attorneys.
Lyle, you're a better lawyer than me. So, anyway... Yeah, they're filing this lawsuit, and I don't know. What do you think about this?
So they're basically saying, hey, you said that I was buying a 2x4. You told me how much money it was. I bought a 2x4. This is not, sir, a 2x4.
This is not 2 inches by 4 inches.
This is a 1.5x4. And it's actually a 4x4 is the one that they're doing in the rules?
Yeah.
Oh, 4x4. So this is a 3.5 by 3.5 inch.
The real dimensions are 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches.
You know why I say 3.5 rather than 3.5? Because if you're writing this, you're going to say 3 and then a space and then the half symbol, 1/2. Uh-huh. And then you're going to do an X, and then you're going to do 3, and then a 1.5 over 2.
Or 3.5.
And that quote, X always looks to me like a multiplication system. But also it's weird that it's like the multiplier of – is it the denominator of the fraction? And if you write it sloppy, it gets really messy.
I'm having a little trouble visualizing this.
Anyway, this is good radio. So they're suing them because obviously they lost a half inch in both directions. That's a lot of square footage of wood, if you will.
Yes. But also –
cubic inches of wood.
Anybody who is built with wood, really any amount, knows what a 2x4 actually is.
In fact, there's standard measurements. I mean, it's a standard.
Like, you can't go and get a 4x4 that's 4 inches by 4 inches without getting someone to cut it for you.
Right. Or go to a hardwood place. And a hardwood place, they do sell in quarters, hence the 4x4 I mentioned
earlier. Or like if you get one of those cinder blocks that the 4x4 goes into, it's a 4x4, but it's 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches.
Yeah,
and everyone calls it a 4x4, and that's the terminology in the industry.
I hate the terminology. You know how annoying it is when you're trying to do stuff without knowing that?
Yeah, it's really annoying. But it's the way it is. So I don't know. I think this is kind of a ridiculous lawsuit.
I think the lawsuit is ridiculous. And I kind of love the idea that their audience base is a home consumer. And the home consumer is expecting to get stuff that they expect. And when they see numbers of sizes, they would expect that they would be those sizes.
But,
like, that's completely – like, if I said to you, here are some 6-inch screws. They're actually only 4 inches. And I sold them to you, they're packaged, you would obviously return them. You'd be like, hey, this is marketed wrong. Please give me money back or give me back 6-inch screws. I need 6-inch screws because I need to go through 2 2x4s.
Right. It is confusing. It's so like, is Home Depot responsible for a
culture of lying to us?
A culture of lying. Yeah, like this is the industry that they're selling within.
So I
like,
guess it depends on whether they're advertising it as standard sizes or if they're advertising it by inch marks. If you call it a 2x4, that's one thing. If I call it a 2 with a quote symbol and then by 4 with a quote symbol, that means 2 inches by 4 inches. That's a different piece of material. So it depends on how you market it.
Here's a question.
You buy a
4 terabyte hard drive.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's...
Where'd your brain go? 4 terabytes. What does terabyte mean? Tera means...
A tera means a million.
Trillion.
A trillion? Oh my gosh, it's big.
A million, billion.
A trillion?
Yeah.
Tera means a trillion?
No. Tera is trillion.
Okay.
Or it's the beginning of a dinosaur. That's always what I think. It's tera... Pterodactyl drive.
Pterodactyl start with a P?
Yeah, it does.
So that's really confusing.
It is. It's kind of like 2x4.
It's a horrible mnemonic.
Tera is 1,000, right? Or sorry, tera is trillion. Tera means trillion because kila means
1,000,
and mega means million, and giga means billion, and tera means trillion.
Okay, so it's not really a trillion bytes.
So four terabytes is what?
I would assume it's, 4 trillion bytes is what you're asking me to say.
That's exactly what I'm trying to get you to say. But you know better.
Sorry, yes. What is it really?
I don't know. You tell me.
I think it's bigger than that.
No.
But when you format it, it's smaller.
Oh.
No, 1,000 bytes, a kilobyte is 1,024 bytes, right? So a megabyte is 1,024 of those, and it, you know, so on. So it's actually bigger than that million bytes.
Well,
but when you format it, it's smaller.
No, it depends on how it's marketed.
Oh, so you're saying that sometimes they sell.
Yeah. So if you get a 4 terabyte hard drive, it's marketed 4 TB.
Which means maybe what?
Does it means four 1024, 1024, 1024. So four larger than
1024.
But then you actually end up getting 3.6 terabytes inside.
But I thought that was because of the...
That's not formatting overhead. That's the difference of multiplying 1,000 times 1,000 versus 1024 times.
They're not... If they were selling the same thing with a kilobyte, it would actually be 1,000 bytes, not 1024.
Okay. Can we define some terms?
Yes.
Okay. There's actually two terms that we're talking about here.
And they sound very similar.
There's terabyte, which is abbreviated TB. And there's tebibyte, which is abbreviated T lowercase I, uppercase B. So this is what this random website's
The Wikipedia entry on it. Shall I read the entry paragraph?
Yeah, if you want to.
The terabyte is a multiple of the unit byte for digital information. The prefix tera represents the fourth power of 1,000 and means 10 to the 12th power in the international system of units. And therefore, 1 terabyte is 1 trillion. Hey, that's right. Bytes. The unit symbol for the terabyte is TB.
In some cases, we say terabyte when we actually mean tebibyte.
And that must be the binary one.
Tebibyte, yeah. Tebibyte is the 2 to the 40 or whatever.
Or
that 1024
to the fourth. If it's,
you're right, yeah, right.
Right, it's a kilobyte to the fourth power.
1024 to the fourth, yeah.
And can, Brian, you're really good with numbers. Maybe you could actually read out the entire friggin' thing.
It is 1,099,511,627,776 bytes.
Wow. That's big. So that's bigger, of course, than a terabyte, if you think of it from a number perspective, because, of course, that's a multiple of 2 to the 40.
To the 40, yeah. So it's like when you are comparing kilobytes to kibibytes, it's actually not very off. If you're comparing megabytes to mebibytes, it's actually quite a bit more off. If you're comparing gigabytes to gigabytes or terabytes to tebibytes, the higher you go, the further away you go, you kind of diverge, right? And so you end up being a larger percentage change every single step up.
Okay. We were talking about wood, right?
We were talking about wood.
Because people have sued over hard drive sizes too.
Have they?
Yeah. In the length of Geekspeak show, yes. The last 20 years it happened. I think I don't remember the story exactly, but yes.
Yeah.
So they're suing. Is this going anywhere? Has there been any conclusion yet?
No.
I am waiting with...
Bated breath?
Well, with wooden breath, I think. That's a way to think about it.
Yeah, I don't know. I know who I'm rooting for. Like, if we're going to change an industry's terminology, we shouldn't pick out, you know, one or two companies that's
okay, but let me
a
just,
part of it.
Let me just give the argument against that. They are not selling to people that know about wood. They're selling to everyday people. Why should an everyday person...
They're selling to both.
But my point is that if I go into a store and that store says, here, I'm selling you wata, and I don't know that actually in the boating industry, wata is a type of sealant, and I drink it and die, that's not my fault. It's their fault for marketing it wrong to me.
Is that actually true?
No, I just made that up. I think there's a Y in there. You know what I'm saying? Like the point is that it doesn't. The layman shouldn't have to know there's an industry name for a thing that actually has a different value. That's they should denote that in some kind of reference that's publicly known that it's actually a different size.
Why don't we take a historically odd measurement and turn it into a perfectly logical measurement, and then everybody can switch over to that new system?
Because it's hard to say two and a half by or whatever the size is, 1.5 by 3.5. It's just so messy.
Or we can just go metric.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh. I think we should go metric, except then when you think about that, it's really, really hard to change. Like, they tried to do it in, what, the 80s or the 90s or something?
But
there are all these signs.
But a 2x4 is just 38 by 89 millimeters.
All right.
Nice round numbers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they're integers. You like integers, right? I like integers. We all like integers. A 4x4 is just 89 by 89.
Okay, so now, here's the question I want to pose to the room. And no one here has the answer to this, unfortunately.
But luckily, we have a large audience. Please follow. Answer if you can.
I'll go to Home Depot tomorrow and check. At Home Depot, do they say 4x4? And then in smaller print, do they say 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches?
Maybe.
Don't bother Googling it, Lyle. I've just spent a couple minutes searching for this. I can't find any barcodes from the store. But anyway, I'm curious about that, because if so, then I don't think this case has any kind of legal ground to stand on. If not, it probably has some legal legs to stand on, but I still don't think that a company like Home Depot should be responsible for... Well, I guess they wouldn't be responsible for changing the industry, is your argument.
Right.
They'd just be responsible for marketing, for marking it.
Another
way
to think of this is to inform their customer base of the truth that life is more complicated.
Welcome to Home Depot. Have a pamphlet. Hear all of the weird idiosyncrasies in the field of constructing anything.
And just wait until we get into the area of color names for paint.
Oh, no. Let's not go there.
It's really interesting, because I bet there's like shapes of like S-hook things that are called something that actually are not what they're for. Like, there's a lot of terminology in construction that's going to be not knowable by the layman. I mean, we have terminology in computer sciences that, forget it, we don't understand them.
We'd never stop. Where do we draw the line?
Exactly. Of course, we don't sell our knowledge as a lie. All right, moving on. Brian, let's talk, even though Ben has an entire awesome podcast about machine learning, including definitions of neural nets. And if you want to know about neural nets, I'd highly suggest the descriptions and episodes of Ben's show, which, of course, is called Linear Digressions. But I digress. Tell us about the neural network story you've got.
Yes. So if you listen to Ben's show, you would actually understand what we're about to talk about. But what I wanted to start with was we haven't really gone in depth into all the many things that came out in Apple's developer conference,
right.
WWDC. But they announced a bunch of technologies that got a lot of geeks excited, at least the ones that are in the Apple universe. And it's not like Apple is releasing things that other companies aren't doing. But in the area of machine learning, they have released a lot of tools, a lot of APIs for Apple developers for the iPhone, for the Mac, to start getting into the machine learning world a little easier than it has been in the past. When the operating systems are released this fall, you will probably see some apps that are starting to use machine learning in ways that you haven't seen before. You're also going to see some funny stuff, including what happens when researchers start playing with recurrent neural nets. This one researcher was working with a recurrent neural net, which is apparently good for imitating phrases and language that it sees in its data set. So what he did was he took 2,000 ancient proverbs and he fed those into this neural network to have the computer spit back at him some lovely phrases for us to live by. But of course, The computer only knows the phrases that it was fed, and it doesn't have any of the cultural context in which these phrases were originally used in. So you get a few oddities out of the system, including a fox smells it better than a fool's for a day, or no songer is a teacup, or a fool is a teacup is as silent as needle, or a fool is a teacup is as silent as a needle in the sail. These are beautiful things. And in fact, if you listen to them without trying to make sense of them, they sound like poetry. But some of them actually do make sense. A good wine makes the best sermon. Actually, I think that's a brilliant one.
That's amazing.
Death when it comes.
Sorry.
Death when it comes has no sheep.
It's great. So this kind of way of producing new works from old works, this recumbent idea.
Recurrent.
Recurrent?
Yes. Right. So, let me just say, a recurrent neural net, in a nutshell, is just a neural net with state or with memory.
Right.
So it can do some stuff and it can remember that stuff. And then it can use that memory in the next stuff that it does.
I wasn't actually speaking of the neural net. I was just speaking of the methodology for taking one set of data that's a large library set and creating a new piece of work. It doesn't have to be a neural net.
Oh, yeah.
So David Cope has been doing this in music for quite a while.
I took his class.
Yeah, he's awesome, yeah. Right? And actually, I was searching for his episodes on GeekSpeak because he was on GeekSpeak early on. Of course, I don't actually have those on because they're prior 2002. But David Cope is this expert in machine
programmatic music creation.
Yeah. And one of the things he's done is produced this system that called Lisa, I think. Mm-hmm. It sounds like that, but Lisa is the early Apple Mac OS.
He has a couple of them.
Yeah, but basically, it takes a large data set of music, just like the Proverbs one you're talking about, remixes it and creates new Bach chorales. So you can have an infinite number of these, which is kind of funny.
Now with music, did it? Was it pleasing? Did it work?
Yeah, sounded like another Bach chorale, except that if you happen to know all of the Bach chorales, you'd be like, I haven't heard this one before.
There's like 27 Bach chorales, and he could make a lot of them. And they all sound very much like Bach chorales. I don't know how many you need in the world. I'm kind of business partners with him around this kind of stuff, but I haven't done anything with him. He's a part of Recumbent Inc. is the name of the company that I've got a share in or something. But his work is fascinating because it does do that neat thing of making new work. But if music, of course, you can't like check it factually if it makes sense. It's just whether it's pleasing. And yeah, when you play these to people that know them even, they can't tell the difference between the ones that are he's generated versus not. But that's not the point we were making. We were talking about language-based ones. And those sound awesome. I love the idea that you can generate one that works really well, that human curation creates really great ones out of that set.
Well, there were some other things that came
out of this.
Can you
read another one or two?
Yeah. I'll get to that in a moment. But there was a couple things that came out of this that were interesting, including that the neural net created a strange obsession with oxen. Now, oxen only appeared in the Proverbs on three different occasions, and yet the number of Proverbs that it spit out with oxen was much higher percentage of that than he could explain through what he fed into it. Things like, an ox is as good as a best, or an ox is as silent for the gain of the brush. So, yeah, many of them make absolutely no sense at all. But then we can get back to the ones that actually have some poetry to them, like a good anvil does not make that the most noise.
Cool. Hmm. Hey, Ben, for those, what are they called again, the neural nets that have state like that?
Recurrent neural nets. Yeah.
Is it possible when you train it to get anomalies that then just stay in the system?
I am not a data scientist. And
would you ask your friends,
I'm just a co-host. But what I was going to say is it's really interesting that when you look at neural networks a lot of the stuff we do with machine learning these days, we create the system, but we don't really know what's going on inside. So when it spits out a bunch of output and it has this bizarre obsession with oxen, we can't say why. We can't ask it exactly. And we might be able to kind of poke at it and figure out what's going on inside, but we fundamentally don't understand what's going on because that's not how we're solving the problem. So previously, we would say, all right, we want to make a bunch of proverbs. We've got this corpus that we're going to go based off of. how would I as a human design a program to do this, right? I'd make that program, it would spit out some output, and I would understand why. I would be able to figure out why is it obsessed with auxin, because I wrote the program and I understand the program.
And that's how Kopp actually did his work.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. But with things like neural networks or recurrent neural networks, we just don't really know how they work when it comes down to actually doing the processing.
So if I understand right, this doesn't even have any concept of grammar. It's just looking at what's coming in and trying to reconstruct something that seems to fit the pattern.
That's the thing.
That's why they're not right.
It might have some concept of grammar as we're thinking about it, but grammar is not exactly a thing. Grammar is like a concept that we as humans have created.
To agree enough to communicate on.
Yeah, but
there's no rule set, really.
In a sense, that's the structure of the words. In a sense, it's the way the words interact. But
yeah, you can parse that with a large enough data set without actually having understanding about it. But there are neural nets that have been trained on large corpuses of language so that they become even more capable of producing accurate grammar.
Yeah, for language learning, actually. Yeah. Yeah, it's really good. And translating between different languages, there are all of these different techniques for if you don't have a lot of training data between language A and language B, because some languages you just don't translate very often between, like, I don't know, Thai and Russian or something like that. You don't have a lot of direct translation stuff there to train your model on. So there are all of these methods for spanning that gap in different interesting ways too.
I would have thought you would have said Klingon and Elven.
Oh, yeah. There probably is actually a decent
decent amount of literature in both those languages.
Yeah, people who are fluent in one might be fluent
but
in the other.
Klingon, I mean, from what I've gleaned about Klingon is that it's not as a complete a language as Elvish.
I don't know. I can't say because I don't know Elvish.
Elvish
but
is
I will
pretty
say,
robust.
But I will say that there are some very clear gaping holes in the vocabulary.
Yes.
For example, you can't say a bridge over troubled waters because the only bridge word they have is for the bridge of a starship.
Yeah, but there's a lot of that kind of problem with Klingon, right? It fits the series and then a little bit of extra. But there's not a full historic context set. Like J.R. Tolkien actually said, hey, the reason I want to make Elvish language is so I can understand the population I've created. So he backwrote a language so that he could define a society, which is pretty insane.
But languages do have these gaps. From what I understand, I'm no expert, but I was told one time that Japanese has no concept of I miss you.
Really?
Yeah. You couldn't say I miss you.
What is it? What do you say instead?
You suck. I love you.
Interesting. Ah, cool. Yeah, definitely. Well, different languages have different.
Oh, yeah. I just looked it up. What is it? Aitai? I don't speak Japanese. Is the most common way that I miss you gets translated in Japanese. Literally, it means I want to see you.
That's good. It's kind of similar. It's actually a better way of saying it than I miss you. It's like instead of you being interesting, my emotional distress about you is more interesting to me rather than I would like to see you. I have been in pain about you.
That's healthier. Yeah.
Feels a little better. I try not to say I miss to my children. I just say
I was going to say in the context of children, that's where I was taught. You don't want to say that. You don't want to take your anxiety and graft it onto them.
Oh, yeah.
While you exist away from me, you're doing me pain.
Oh,
is that
sad.
How you raise your children?
If you want to learn more about recurrent neural nets, not from any of us, but from someone who actually knows what they're talking about with me asking questions, November 27th, 2016, we did an episode of Linear Digressions called Recurrent Neural Nets, predictably. So you can Google that, or we'll have a link on the show page to that.
We actually have links about all the things we talk about up at geekspeak.org. Please visit our site. Enjoy it. You can even, while you're there, take a look at the support link and see how you might want to support our program. Hey, Brian, tell us about maps.
Yeah, about
where
maps.
Where is this going?
This is where Ben and I take over the show and Lyle doesn't know what's going on. So I thought this was pretty fun. It's totally out of the realm of technology, but if you were like me growing up in the 80s, you probably read a few choose-your-own-adventure books.
Yes.
What I didn't know is that they still live on through a new publisher, and this new publisher did something that, really caught my imagination. The publisher, which I will find the name of in just a moment, has included in each of the Choose It Your Own Adventure books a map of the different possibilities. And what's really interesting is when you look and compare the maps between each of the books, they're wildly different. The first two Choose Your Own Adventures that were published have so many more branches in their narrative. Just about every page allows you to make a choice.
These are the early books?
These are the two earliest books.
That's really beautiful looking at those pictures.
Yeah, but there's so many choices that nearly at the end of every page, not everyone, but you get to make a choice of where you want the story to go. And because of that, the narrative branches off vastly more. There's places where it loops back to other branches. So you can actually, if you think of this as a tree, you can jump from one branch to another because of your choice. And all of these maps include that. So these first two books had more than any other, and I believe it was 42 different endings in each one of them.
That sounds really expensive if you're the author. Like, because you have to build all of those different branches.
Well, it depends whether you're talking about trying to get somebody to read more, where they just want to go back and find every ending. You can get a lot of bang for your buck that way.
There's a whole game theory part at UCSC, graduate programs and stuff, with people like Aaron Reed, who's this amazing author of multi-branching narrative. They do it in a game context, but if you think of like current contemporary games, they do this too, especially if they have any kind of narrative in them. But Aaron's got a whole book called Inform 7, which is like creative interactive fiction. And he got kind of famous in that space because the tools that allow you to make interactive fiction now that does this kind of non-linear stuff is pretty dense and pretty supportive. But it's neat that the earlier books are actually much more dense.
Yeah,
story narrative.
When they were just trying to learn the format, there were vastly more choices in there. As you go through the history of it, you get to some storylines that they don't even look like a tree. They just look like a few choices with where you get to read 10, 15 pages before you get to make the choice. In some of them, you get a book that should you make one wrong choice, you're only reading 6 pages before it ends.
That's awesome. I mean, of course, obviously that book's designed to be read multiple times, right?
Of
course. Explore the story arc or something.
Right.
Yeah, the book self-destructs.
That'd be awesome. Like, you can like turn to a page, but when you do, glue injects into the pages that you didn't open.
So the company's name is Chuzico, if I am saying that right. These maps were pretty fascinating. And take a look if you're interested. We'll post the link up there. Just a couple more stats to finish it off is the most decision points out of any book was Balloon by the Sahara. Sorry, Balloon by the Sahara. And that you had 48 choices at which you could choose a different route.
That's a lot. That's incredible. I used to read the R.L. Stine books when I was a kid. He made a couple of Choose Your Own Adventure books. Of course, they all ended horribly. it was about that time when I started getting a little sensitive to them and kind of scared of them. And I just decided, you know what? One way to handle this is to just read them straight through.
It's funny you say that because there was one other thing I forgot to mention, which was on the studies of the earlier ones, 75% of the endings were unfavorable or deadly.
Well, because of course, it kind of makes sense in the sense that if you want the person to read your story and it terminates in a horrible way, they're more likely to back up and read more. If it's like every time it's perfect, well, you're kind of done with the book. You won.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a game, if it's a challenge.
Well, there's another company that's doing that, the Choose Your Own Interactive blah, blah, blah. This company, it's a little company called Netflix.
Oh, that's the company I work for.
Yeah, hey. Did you know that this was launching?
That's what I've been doing for the last 6 months.
You're kidding.
No. So wait, there's a Choose Your Own Adventure book on Netflix?
There's a Choose Your Own Adventure show.
They mail it to you in a little sleeve,
right.
And you send it back when you're done.
Glue sold separately. Yeah. What's the story? What's the full coverage story? What is it on? We got the biggest coverage of this I saw was on the cover of the business page at New York Times, which was kind of cool.
I'm looking at thenextweb.com, my favorite website. I've probably never visited it before. they're talking about the first two interactive shows that will be available are Puss in Book, Trapped in an Epic Tale, and Buddy Thunderstruck, The Maybe Pile. And Puss in Book launched a couple days ago.
Monday night at midnight, last Monday night, after we did our live show last week, Brian, I went back to my house and got on the VPN and made sure that everything would work for Puss in Book launching globally. We launched in Sweden a month earlier to test it, and Puss in Book is by DreamWorks. And you know the Shrek universe?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you know Puss...
And Boots.
And Boots. He has a whole series with us. We've done an original series with them, and then they did a one-off movie called Puss in Book. And it's with that character. And as you go along the story arc, you get to decide what happens next. It's actually a lot of fun. Great actors, good music. It's cool. And you can do this on some television devices and most up-to-date iOS devices with the most up-to-date app. Version 9.23 of the iOS app.
So
not that you need to know that. Just get the most latest one. It'll be fine.
You told me you were going to go and monitor the rollout that night.
Yeah.
And then I noticed there's like, at least one, maybe two other releases in the app that week.
We have a lot of original titles. And so there. Oh, you mean the app?
Yeah, the app.
We did release a little more frequently than our regular scheduled stories.
So what age is this story for?
I don't know what it actually – I did see that at one point it's for a lot of age ranges. So it's not like it's very specific. But, you know, I think – I don't know. I mean, I've been enjoying watching it. Then again, I know it really well. There's a few gems in it that are amazing. You've got to find the fish song because it's fantastic. In fact, every time I want to show it to somebody, I show them this fish song, which is just this like esoteric thing that's like a hallucinated dream. There's a lot of funny bits in it. It's good writing. I've enjoyed it, and I'm 40-something. So I don't know.
So I have a question. It seems like this is a lot of obviously work on the creative side because you've got to produce more than your normal amount of content because you have to create all these branches, right? On the technical side, is this just a couple extra videos, some buttons?
No, it's actually pretty complicated. We did a lot of
work. Working on this for a while.
Yeah, we've been doing this for a while. We've actually, the interactive group I've been on for, 2.5 years. We've done other titles too. You can also find on our service Kong, King of the Apes. And that's an animated series, which I would say is younger aimed, but it's kind of like an adventure show. And in that one, as you watch it on supported devices, we have more supported devices on that. As you watch it, you get notified that you get extra content. And at the end of the show, you get to see extra videos based on what you've seen so far. And that's kind of neat. That's called so that's a different type of title. And then we did a title that actually ran for a while and we turned it off. That was the one I was most invested in. And we decided to turn it off because it wasn't working out. So we do research. And then this one is kind of the, you know, from a perspective of interactive content or content that the user gets to engage with at some level, this is kind of the one that's easy to understand the most, right? You're like, here's a story arc that you can engage in and you kind of decide how the story goes. So it's been kind of neat. From a technical perspective of doing this, when you're playing back streaming video, the video is not on your device all the time. It's actually being sent to your device. And there's a couple reasons for that. For iOS, you don't actually want to store all that video. TVs don't actually have hard drives, so they can't store the video. So you have to send the bits fast enough for the device to get them and render them on screen, but not too fast that it fills up the device, and not too slow that it gets blocky and times out. So this
that seems like normal video playback stuff right there.
Right. So this whole streaming engine of Netflix that we do so well is to make sure that the best stream quality you can get gets served to you. And so if, you know, you have bad network, you still get a video, but it's lower quality.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So we hone that really well to be as best quality as possible. When you're doing branching content, you don't know what the next segment of video is because the video is going along. And depending on what the person decides to do, it could either keep playing or it could jump somewhere completely else in the stream.
So when I'm at home and I start up a Netflix video, it can take a second or two before it starts playing.
Right. That's called buffering. Obviously, you and I, we all know this, what this is called, buffering. And basically what's happening is enough bits are getting on there that if there's a lag and latency, you won't have a stumble. So we have a lot.
Saving up a little bit just in case.
Yeah, saving up a little bit just in case. I remember the first time I ever heard of this practice was for CD, portable CD, Walkman CD drives.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They had to spin extra fast and read extra data so that if you jostled and destroyed the head movement, like running, you'd still get audio. And I remember playing with the first one I got. It was fantastic.
Yeah, my new super fancy Denon did not do that.
Right, so you had to be careful. You couldn't move it around.
Mine did 48 seconds of buffering.
Nice. That's some serious jogging. Mm-hmm. So in network, it's the same type of idea that you might at some point not get data, and therefore you have to have some on there. At the same time, you also don't want to spin for too long before you start the show, because maybe you're like, eh, I'll just turn it off. I'll go do my dishes.
Right. So
we hone our system.
So before this, Netflix just had to deal with that once at the beginning. And then once you're going, and Netflix knows what bits to send you.
And more importantly, as you're playing, you're getting as much buffer as you can. And if you get more buffer, then you upgrade your quality state. You just step to that because you can get more.
Right.
And so the whole system's kind of honing to get the best quality speed. But now all of a sudden you have this weird thing that comes. Down the line in a little bit is going to be this point where we have to jump. Maybe. If the user says, keep going, everything's fine. But if the user says, no, I want to see this other storyline, the video is not right there in the stream. I can't necessarily buffer two of those because our systems don't do that. So what we did is we made the systems do that. So now what we're doing is we're buffering two videos or two parts of the video.
So I have a question for you. Mm. Touching code like that, like code that has been honed and there are a bunch of people who know way more about you than that particular system have gotten it perfect. And now you got to go in there and change this code.
This was not just me doing this kind of stuff. So we're talking about a team, you know, the company invested in doing this. Yeah.
Right.
So I don't think I did any video playback code. I did.
Thank God.
What are you trying to say, man? I'm a UI engineer, right? I mean, I do user interface.
I don't want to touch. I don't want to touch like post on Facebook, right?
Right.
Because everybody interacts with that component. Like, there is nothing wrong with that component.
Comment, right?
So there's nothing wrong with that component. I can't fix that component. If I want to add a feature to that component, I'm probably going to break something.
Red happened to work fast and break things.
A gajillion. That's not a motto anymore. It was move fast and break things. And then we realized, we should change that to move fast with stable infrastructure.
that's awesome.
What that became, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a fun project. And so though there's a lot of, you know, technical details, obviously, to doing all this. And a lot of that has to do with momentum of a company, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like for the longest time, what do we do? We play a video. What do we want to do now? We want to play two videos kind of at the same time, but not really. That's just a different paradigm. So you can imagine everywhere in the code where you assume video, you now have to say videos. And that's
video?
Video?
Videos?
Yeah, exactly.
So just wait until the creatives come to you and say, okay, we want to have 10 different possibilities. No, we want 40 different possibilities.
Yes, we are engaging in this and we're moving forward with other titles. You mentioned another one, Buddy Thunderstruck, which that one is it's already on the service. We already have a whole season of Buddy Thunderstruck. And if you haven't tried it, I actually have a hat for Buddy Thunderstruck. It's kind of like
a real hat, not a virtual.
Yeah, like a physical hat. I just found it the other night. Buddy Thunderstruck, when I read the deck for the show, like the script, the Bible, every time you do a show, the creatives have to create this thing that kind of is the go-to answer, theme, feel, and everybody reads that thing. That's why they call it a Bible. I think this comes from just general show, you know, making movies and stuff.
Yeah.
But this show is stop animation. It's on the service now. It's stop animation of like puppetry and felt puppets kind of, and all the characters are animals. And Buddy Thunderstruck and his sidekick race trucks, and they like crash through people's houses, and everybody loves them. And the humor is just, I think it's pretty funny. I couldn't get my kids into it. But the branching one is just, you get to decide what crazy things they do. So
nice.
I feel like I'm an ad for Netflix. That's not my intent at all. But it is technically has been really challenging.
You also have been working on this for 6 months.
Maybe I'm exaggerating there, but yeah, I've been working on it for a long time.
Yeah.
And a lot of really great people have been working on it. So it's kind of neat to see it. So if you're curious about what I do and you've got a contemporary television / PlayStation 3 / Xbox or an iOS device running the latest operating system and you have Netflix, you can try this thing out and give me feedback if you want.
I understand. I work on personalized video at Facebook. So
what does that mean?
Friendversary, faceversary, birthday, all the videos that are like, hey.
The videos that have my stuff in them, pictures of my friends and family in them, you help make that.
Yeah.
So you just do a lot of video editing. How many can you do today?
I do thousands a minute.
It's so cool because yesterday was Miles' birthday. And so earlier today, we were talking about
it. I'm like, hey, Miles, did you get a video? I made a video for you.
He's like, I got it, but I didn't look at it. I'm like, dude, share it with me. I want to see it. Because I haven't seen this one.
This is what I do
this
all
day. This is one with the tiered cakes, the cake that's like you kind of fly around the cake and
opens
all your friends and fireworks and.
Yeah. Now, when I saw it, the first thing I thought, because I have some background in video as well, is like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if this is different all the time? So I don't see the same one for all of my friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you asked a question of Miles.
Oh, yeah. So there's a high version and a low content version. So if you don't have a lot of friends who post it on your wall,
It doesn't get rubbed in your face.
I think Miles actually hides his birth date, so it's his own fault for doing that.
Yeah,
and like don't you modify your birth date in every service? Like it's always.
What's that?
Don't you modify your birth date?
I set my birth date to be different on all of the different social accounts I have.
So you know where people are finding out where
that
your birth
is not my intention.
Oh, okay. What for?
Well, because if I share my birthday as November 10th or whatever it is on whatever service. And then somebody who wants to compromise my bank account happens to have access to that. Like, why do bank accounts use birthdays as security? It doesn't make any sense.
So bad. Well, anyway, awesome. I totally loved your video.
Congratulations on launching.
Well, thank you very much.
That's really exciting.
We're going to have time for one more story. But first, I would like to go ahead and mention that GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor. Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we made it. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Today's crazy title by Mr. Greg Merkley. He's still on with us. Good. Hamilton sizes up interactive luggage. What's the luggage for?
You know when you're rolling your luggage to the airport and it destabilizes and it goes...
You mean rolling it oscillates?
Oscillates and then falls on the... It turns over. And then you're dragging this like...
Yes, I do know what you're talking about.
It's horrible.
Normally, it's when you have something balanced on top of that piece of luggage, too.
Oh, yeah, that's the worst.
Yeah.
Why does that happen? So some scientists actually studied this. They made a little mock-up of a tiny tiny little thing, put it on a treadmill.
I love that you're holding it with just your first tip, your finger and your thumb.
Just my little fingers. And they put it on a treadmill, and they intentionally destabilized it and watched what happened. And they kind of figured out why. It's basically that the suitcase's handle pulls from the middle, and since the wheels are at the sides, if the suitcase swerves, then the wheels swerve, pulling it inward. And so it actually reinforces its own swerviness, right?
Yeah.
And then gravity pulls it back down to the ground.
Because the angle of pulling when it rotates is now superset, like offset,
it's a little
opposite
bit
more so,
right?
Because the handle has duality of it.
Right.
Right. Okay. I'm imagining it's very hard to explain on radio, but
yeah, I'm not gonna
I get what
try.
You're saying. What's the solution?
But if you wanted to amplify it, you'd have a single pole coming out of the center, and that would be the maximum amplification of that?
No, the dual part of it's part of the amplification process, because as it rotates, now you're pulling in the opposite side.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so whatever wheel you're on is trying to go towards the center.
Okay.
And that destabilizes. That makes it worse and worse and worse. And so the way you... So you can amplify it by just making the suitcase more upright. And you can help fix it by making the suitcase a little bit more parallel to the ground. So basically lower the handle. The other thing you can do, though, is that the oscillations they found, the speed of the oscillations is proportional to the speed that you're pulling the luggage at, or inversely proportional.
Oh, so you just go faster?
You just go faster. Yeah, and like if you have a destabilizing
luggage, my car is worrying too. I just go faster.
Right, it's not what you intuitively want to do, but it works.
Awesome. Well, thank you,
anyway,
Ben.
Check out the site. There's this ridiculous video of this little thing with these weights on either side. It's fun.
Well, Ben Jaffe and Brian Young, thank you so much for joining me on episode 23 of season 17.
Thank you, Lyle.
It's a blast. Thanks.
I got to say something.
Yeah.
I dropped two more Hamilton quotes in the show.
Okay, if you're really a Hamilton fan, find the times when Ben dropped the two Hamilton quotes, I didn't edit them out.
Just say what they are. Just tweet at us.
Tweet us what they are.
Message on Facebook. My brother will get them both. I know that.
I'm sure. I'm sure my kids will get them both if they listen to the show. I'm so sad.
Maybe they'll listen to the show because of that.